Today's program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. Made with a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. For more information, visit www.rt11.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
You're listening to Feast Meets West, the show tracing the stories behind your favorite Asian dishes. I'm your host, Linda Liu. We are broadcasting live from Heritage Radio Network at Roberta's Pizza in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Every episode, we dig deep on a dish or an aspect of Asian cuisine, and we interview experts on the topic. Today, we are talking about izakaya culture, food, and drinks. And for those who are unfamiliar, an izakaya is traditionally an informal gastropub found in Japan. And izakayas have been compared to, say, Irish pubs, tapas bars, and American taverns, but more on the differences later. And people really love izakayas. I mean, there's obvious reasons. They're casual, fun places to drink, and have now become synonymous with tasty and affordable food options, too. So, I found on Wikipedia, and I gotta name my sources, that the word izakaya is a compound word consisting of I, to stay, and sakaya, sake shop, indicating that izakaya originated from sake shops that allowed customers to sit on the premises to drink. And okay, this now makes a lot of sense why Rick Smith of Sakaya NYC named him his premium sake shop in the East Village exactly that, Sakaya. For those that tuned in last season, you'll recall Rick joined us to unpack the fundamentals of sake. Today, we'll also be graduating from Sake 101 to discuss how it pairs with food, as our guest tonight is John McCarthy, a certified sake sommelier, chef and owner of the Japanese izakaya-inspired Oka in Murray Hill, as well as the Crimson Sparrow restaurant in Hudson, New York. John is a former lawyer who gave up a legal career to go into food. After graduating from the French Culinary Institute at the top of his class, he worked for Chef Wiley Dufresne at WD-50 for several years, ultimately becoming Chef Wiley's research and development cook. Sounds fun. He then opened the Crimson Sparrow, which serves a tasting menu of cuisine that employs French and Japanese technique and incorporates flavors and ingredients primarily from Japan and local farms surrounding the Hudson. And now, Oka. Welcome to the show, John.
Thank you. Great to be here.
So we usually like to start out our show by asking our guests, what's the best thing you ate recently? And I'll go first, so you have a moment to think. I went by Coat recently, which is a new Korean steakhouse in Flatiron. My friends and I had the butcher's feast, where they lay out four cuts of meat, and they grill it for you just like at a Korean barbecue spot, but like a way fancier iteration of that. Everything was delicious, but what was a particularly great end to the meal was this paper cup at the end served with vanilla custard soft serve. And on top of it was drizzled a soy sauce caramel. So a nice play on the salted caramel thing.
Nice.
What about you, John? What have you been eating?
Well, I'm just, as you were discussing that, I was, and said coat, which I believe is Korean-inspired steakhouse.
Yeah.
I have not yet been, but I immediately thought of my my friend Hoonie Kim's duck bokki at Hanjeon, which I did spend some time in Korea. Whenever I eat that dish, it takes me back to Korea. I think it's just a phenomenal dish. I think a couple of years ago, it may have been voted by someone, some organization, as one of the 10 best dishes in New York or something. But it's consistently one of my favorite dishes in New York.
So what is that? What does it look
It's a Korean rice cake with gochujang and pork and I guess sometimes maybe a little fish fillet or something, but dried fish, dried squid. But it's incredibly delicious. Spicy, served with an egg, so you can sort of take the yolk and make it a little less spicy.
Oh, hearty and perfect for the winter.
Perfect for winter time.
Okay, so John, you've spent a considerable amount of time in Japan.
Not enough time.
Never enough.
Never enough.
But a good amount of time.
Yeah, I mean, I've been to Japan several times. I haven't spent a lengthy period of time there. The longest I've spent there is maybe 6 or 7 weeks. But I try to go every year, and hopefully, again, I'll be going in March.
Awesome. So based on your experiences there, what does the izakaya scene look like these days?
These days, meaning the last time I was there. I enjoy... you know, people ask me, well, where should I go when I go eat in Japan? And you know, I have a couple of recommendations, but my best experiences in Japan have really been turning down alleys and finding small little spots. You know, recommendations of friends that have sent me to various places in Japan to you know, taste izakaya food. But, you know, it's really sort of the adventure of finding a small spot. Whether it's the soundtrack that draws you in, the fact that it's a yakitori place or some other specialty of the house. You know, this is why sometimes it's difficult for me to give recommendations, because it's usually really late at night. I'm deep into some study of sake or shochu, and I find this great place that maybe I'm not able to find again. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the food memory is still there.
That sounds great. A study is a good way to put it.
Well, research and development. Whatever the IRS needs to hear to write off that trip, that's fine.
And so typically, what does like a izakaya look like? Does it specialize in something? Does it have typical menu items?
It can. I stray away from calling oka an izakaya because it doesn't look like much of an izakaya that I've seen in Japan. Mm-hmm. Typically, they're very small. They're run by, you know, maybe a husband and wife or an older couple. It can be younger couples as well. But typically, they're hidden places, small, off the beaten path, either maybe even in a basement or sub-level. And that's just a very general description of them, the ones that I've found. There are larger izakaya that, you know, they're chain izakaya now. Mm. But, you know, typically you go in and you know, the procedure is to start out with maybe a beer, and then you get some type of an amuse or something. And then you order small plates during the course of your time spent at the izakaya. And you're trying to taste different dishes with sake, if you're drinking shochu. And, you know, typically at the end, maybe you get some rice or noodles to end the night.
Yeah.
Soak good. It all up.
That's a good order of ordering. So
I recommend it.
So you were saying to me when we spoke previously that, say, comparing the food or the dishes at an izakaya as being tapas is not totally accurate. Could you, like, elaborate a bit more on that?
Well, I guess in a way it's – I'm not very familiar with Spanish tapas. I mean, I've eaten it. Many Spanish restaurants and had tapas food before. I think the comparison can be made there. I think
the small dishes set up, sharing.
Yeah, I mean, what I'm trying to do though at Oka is really sort of take the inspiration of izakaya, and create dishes that may fairly be recognizable from a Japanese izakaya, but have my own take and spin on them. You know, all of our dishes, you know, izakaya are supposed to be reasonably priced. I don't like the word cheap, but affordable dishes.
Mm-hmm.
All the dishes at Oka, I think, right now are between $5 and $17. That's the entire menu. That's 23 dishes. We're expanding, but that price point is where we're trying to keep it.
Mm-hmm. So anyone can dine there.
Anyone, everyone. You know, we're trying to make it, in the spirit of an izakaya in Japan, a place where you can go either after work or, mm-hmm. you know, later at night or at any time, sit down, enjoy, you know, a couple of dishes and drink some either sake or shochu or beer or not at all. I had someone call for the first time in my career and actually ask over the phone. They said, "We don't drink, but can we come in?" And I said, "Sure, I also serve food." I never had that question before, but if you don't drink and you want to come in, yes, we serve you food. But I think the idea is to provide, you know, a place where people can go in and enjoy a variety of dishes. And the variety of dishes really is sort of driven to allow you to try different types of sake or different types of beverages. We have a strong cocktail program as well if you want to start out with a cocktail. But the idea is to give you vehicles to see how food or various food pairs with the sake, or better yet, to pair your sake with the different dishes on the menu.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, could you walk us through some of your signature dishes and how you prepare them?
Sure. The top five dishes at Oka right now are, one, the karaage, fried chicken. It's buttermilk brined for a couple of days, and then dredged in a AP flour / other ingredient mix, which is state secret. Mm-hmm. The second highest selling dish, which was surprising to me over the course of the last several months, is the yellowtail hamachi, collar, mm-hmm. kama. We grill it with a soy glaze. We dress it with during the course of the grill with a yuzu vinaigrette and finish it with a considerable amount of citrus zest. It sells incredibly well. And what's been great about it is watching people that have never eaten it before
mm-hmm.
order it and then want to learn how to eat it. And once they do, they order it every single time they're in. So that's been somewhat of a pleasant surprise and really, really fun to watch. Then the pork tenderloin, the tonkatsu.
Mm-hmm.
We brine the pork for at least 24 hours and then serve it over a bed of napa cabbage with a yuzu.
Yeah, I had that one. It was so crispy and zesty, delicious.
Yeah, it's breaded at least 24 hours ahead of time, so or 12 hours ahead of time. But then after that, you know, we've got a mixture of dishes that sort of fall from 4th to 10th.
Mm-hmm.
One is a salmon roe ikura dish with yeasted sunchoke puree and sunchoke chips.
So I feel like that's where it differs from like a traditional izakaya dish.
Yeah, I think you could go into every izakaya in Japan and not find that dish.
Yeah.
But, you know, the idea behind that was really to provide something that's a bit different to the diner. I mean, we have an edamame dish right now on the menu, but it's a bit different. It's more of an edamame salad with Korean dried chili, togarashi, kupi mayo, and it's mm-hmm. served on a Komodo shrimp cracker. So it's really kind of like a dip in a salad,
mm-hmm.
But with, you know, edamame salad. So we've done a couple of different things with ingredients just to make it more unique.
Yeah. Like the first three things you listed off, I was like, okay, yeah, I feel like you could find that in Japan, but then everything else.
Let's depart.
So where do you draw your inspiration for that?
I don't exactly know. I mean, we for the record, the Crimson Sparrow did close in November.
Mm.
We had a fun time up there for five years, five plus years, five and a half years. But The good news is now I'm at Oka every day, really enjoying it. We had sort of two different restaurants at the Crimson Sparrow. One was a fine dining restaurant where we did a tasting menu. It could range from anywhere from $85 to $125 at any given time. But then we had a bar in the front and an outdoor courtyard where we tried to serve more informal dishes. So it became more of a research and development laboratory for what then became Oka, a catalog of recipes and dishes that I can use at Oka, which is great because there's nothing better than coming into a situation like that, having already tried out a bunch of these dishes and honed the recipes, but also taking something that may have been done at the Crimson Sparrow, either on the tasting menu or the bar menu, and kind of turning it around a little bit, fine-tuning it, tweaking it, seeing how it would work inside of a more casual setting like Oka. So it's really
What about the clientele, like, you know, New York City versus Hudson?
Well, in fairness to the Crimson Sparrow, most of our clientele, I would say almost 80% of it to 90% of it, when they'd make reservations, they were all 212-646-7188 area code. So it was really, I was serving New York, but only about 2 hours north of it.
Yeah.
Of the city. So coming back to New York, it's sort of the same clientele. It's just an urban setting versus a rural setting.
Yeah.
It's fun. I see a lot of people actually that have been to the Crimson Sparrow in Oka, which is really nice. People have found me and said, you know, I only live 6 blocks from here, so great. See you more.
That's awesome. It's great to hear that.
Yeah.
We're going to take a really short break, and we'll be right back with more Feast Meets West.
The following program has been brought to you by Route 11 Potato Chips. From the moment Route 11 Potato Chips dropped their first batch of chips back in the early days of 1992, they understood their destiny as a high-quality producer. Instead of succumbing to the frenzy of mass production, they took advantage of their small size and made chipping a personal art form. The payoff was immediate, an incredible potato chip. With a secret recipe and superior ingredients, their mission is to make an outstanding product in a safe and clean environment. In this world of uncertainty that we live in, Route 11 Potato Chips believes comfort food should be just that. Know where your food comes from. For more information, visit RT11.com.
Welcome back. You're listening to Feast Meets West. Okay, John, now on to the alcoholic offerings at Oka.
Everyone asks about alcohol, but always says, okay, John. I am not an expert. I am neither an authority. I'm just well-practiced.
Studied.
Studied
man.
Well-researched.
yeah, sure. So what does the beverage menu look like at Oka?
So Oka has, let's start with the top of the menu, the cocktails. We've got some really great cocktails. Christina Phelps, a friend of mine, is our head bartender there. We've put together a list of cocktails that essentially draw somewhat from the Crimson Sparrow and what I was doing there. And then Christina's had some great ideas and great drinks put on as well. So it's really a beautiful cocktail menu. The next, we have one draft beer, and we decided we would just try to serve, I don't know, one of my favorites and not have to, you know, have eight.
Which one is
ten.
That?
Asahi Super Dry. It is delicious. But we also have a selection of canned and bottled beers. We have Echigo's Koshi Hikari, Orion's Lager, and we have a Kanazawa Dark Ale as well in bottle. And then we have a shochu list that is, I think, is about 16 or 17 bottles large. It's going to grow larger as we grow. But it has a pretty diverse selection across the, Imo sweet potato, mungi, which is the barley, and okome, which is the rice. My friend Stephen Lyman and Chris Johnson are really the experts that I would turn to go beyond in the next level with the shochu. Stephen has a company and a program called Kanpai US, and he does talks on shochu. And then, you know, my friends Andrew Richardson and Chris Johnson of World Sake, they've helped me, and Jamie Graves have helped me put together a pretty great sake list. Really wonderful sake, premium sake, and you know, we're expanding that as well. We serve it in, by glass, carafe, and bottle.
So and I had the pleasure of trying the flights. That was really fun.
It was actually the night you were there was the first night we actually got the flights program up and
running. I approve it.
Yeah, fantastic. we have four different flights right now. And, you know, we'll change those out, hopefully, you know, seasonally or just to make it a bit diverse for the...
Yeah, how did you come up with those kind of selections per flight?
Well, what we tried to do with them was really... you know, there's one that's called the Oka flight or 439 flight, which is really just three sake that are pretty diverse. So we do have people that come in never tried sake before. So we tried to offer them, you know, a Nagori, a Ginjo, and maybe a Yamahai. And then, you know, we have one flight that's just Ginjos and Junmai Ginjos so that you can see the differences, you know, among them. I think another one of them is the Yamahai and Kimoto flight, which is... you know, that's a category unto itself, and you know, it's incredibly delicious, but maybe people haven't tried that particular style before. So we give them an option of, you know, three different ones they can try. And what we're finding is that it's a great educational tool.
Yeah.
And it's also, it's a great way to select the next carafe you want to get. So we're seeing a lot of that, which is great. I mean, it's not supposed to be, you know, work or education, but, you know, if you have an opportunity to try three sake that you probably wouldn't order by the glass because it's a little too much, then this is the way to do it.
Yeah, that actually kind of answers my next question, because I was going to ask you, what would you recommend sake newcomers, you know, ordering from your menu for the first time?
Dewazakura makes a sake that they've called or branded Oka. So why not start there?
Yeah.
It's a beautiful Ginjo sake, a bit floral, but very, very nice entry into sake. You know, that's when I, why not go with the same named sake, right?
And do you have a strategy of how to pair sake with, you know, what types of like foods or flavors and maybe like examples of that on your menu?
Yeah, I think there is, you know, when we have, we spend a considerable amount of time with the staff sort of discussing the type of sake or specific sake that would go with a certain dish. You know, spicier dishes that have, you know, some heat to them, typically, you know, we'll point them towards, you know, say a Nagori or something with a, you know, heavier, richer mouthfeel that helps sort of tamp down the heat. There are some things on the menu that are a bit funkier. I find it a bit surprising that we sell as much. There's a sake called Tamagawa Heirloom, red label. It's incredibly complex. It's rich. And frankly, it's one that surprises me that people, you know, taste. And it's, I guess it's because it's so different. We sell a lot of it. And it goes well with, say, grilled meats or, you know, I guess maybe our beef tartare would be a good match for that as well. So we do spend a considerable amount of time trying to help the diner if they're interested in that. You know, the flights have helped a little bit because people will ask us, you know, what do I pair with the Yamahai or Kimoto? You know, we can suggest some dishes for them that'll help that experience along a little bit.
And so you mentioned what, you know, kind of surprised you in terms of, what diners have been ordering. What did you wish diners ordered more of?
More.
Just overall everything.
No, I think that, so far, I think we've been very, very pleased with the, reception, that we've gotten for not only the menu, but also the sake list, the shochu list, the availability of, or I should say the accessibility of the menu in terms of pricing. We have regular customers that come in and eat the same thing every day, and I have no problem with that whatsoever, because once you find something you like, it, you might as well keep with it and maybe stray once in a while to see what else is there. I've changed the menu since we've opened. I flipped pretty much the whole menu over after October 1.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to hold this menu, with a couple of exceptions, through till the spring.
Yeah.
You know, maybe
just
some
specials.
Just adapting
to seasonality? Or?
Seasonality, but also, you know, we're mindful that we have a considerable number of local people, I'd say local neighborhood people, that do come in. I still want to keep it fresh and interesting for them. So we will be making some changes, but, you know, I've been very, very pleasantly surprised. I mean, this is the first restaurant that I've owned in New York, so, you know, all my experience has been pretty much upstate, but it's been fun, so really fun so far.
That's great.
We have an open kitchen, so as we're cooking, we get to see the diners' reactions, and sometimes you don't want to see the diners' reactions, but by and large, the reaction's been favorable, so it's been a sort of rewarding experience for us. We also are able to interact with the diner maybe a lot more than you would if you were, say, downstairs or behind a door, which is also fun, because I can talk to them about sake and, you know, how dishes are made and where we get ingredients and things like that. So it's been fun.
Yeah. And so what are you drinking these days?
Lots.
Anything that stands out from the sake category?
I have been, two things. I enjoy rye whiskey.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But we have a shochu called Yamasemi, which is a rice kome shochu. I enjoy it. It's really fantastic. It's light. It's refreshing to me. But I should also mention, we have a pretty extensive Japanese whiskey selection.
Mm-hmm.
Hakushu, Yamazaki, Iwai, Hibiki.
Mm-hmm.
We've got pretty much all the major stars and heavy hitters. So I try to stay away from those because, you know, I'm not yet entitled.
They're easy to drink. They go down smooth.
Too easy.
Yeah. Oh, that's a great list. I mean, you know, as much as you're like having a diverse, like hot, cold options on your food menu, also just so many options for beverages too.
We're a 32 seat restaurant, but I think we've pulled together pretty much everything that you would look for in a high-end restaurant. I guess I would say for in terms of like say a sake program or whiskey program. But we've also tried to make it accessible to the point, on the price point, but also in terms of how it works and fits within the culinary program.
Mm-hmm.
So, I'm pretty happy with it. I'm pretty proud of it. And, you know, we've got a great staff that is really behind it as well.
Yeah. And do you feel like, I was going to originally ask this about just sake, but I think about all kind of like Japanese alcoholic beverages. Do you think they're kind of having a moment right now? Is there a general trend that you're seeing, particularly in the city, of how they're being received or being like served?
Well, I think, there's obviously been a great expansion of sushi restaurants and the like in New York. And, you know, there was recently an article as to whether you should even drink sake with sushi and what beverages are appropriate with sushi, et cetera, et cetera. But I think there's been an increasing awareness and educational basis to understanding what sake is. I have friends that are invested emotionally and whatnot inside and maybe financially in the sake world. I also have friends that are emotionally invested and deep into the shochu world.
Mm-hmm.
New York should be very aware that they're about to have their own sake brewery in Brooklyn, Brooklyn Kura. And I think their sake is going to be available soon, but I've had the opportunity and pleasure to taste, you know, one or two things from them, and I cannot wait. It's delicious. So in this borough, we're about to have a sake brewery.
Right,
how exciting
is that?
Right, when
it's so readily available.
And I think with that comes, you know, an increasing educational awareness, and maybe that helps spur more sake sales in New York beyond, you know, where we are now, which would of course be great news for everyone involved, including the premium brewers in Japan. Mm-hmm. Can't be a bad thing.
Yeah. Global awareness.
Global awareness. I mean, I think my shochu friend told me that I think shochu has now overtaken sake as the number one consumed alcoholic beverage in Japan.
Ooh.
So
I wanted to hear about that trend. What was the turning point? Yeah.
I don't know what the turning point is. I'm sure he can give you more of a cultural reason for it. Mm-hmm. But my individual effort at Oka is to somehow get New Yorkers to drink enough sake so that we're, you know, making sure all of the brewers of sake in Japan, you know, keep pace. So how about that?
Yeah. Challenge accepted.
It's one of my New Year's resolutions is to just drink more.
Yeah. So it's the new year, start of 2018. What do you have planned for yourself and Oka for the rest of the year?
Wow. We're going to try to continue to do events. We've done past events with some sake brewers. We did an event with Ichiko, which is a distiller of shochu. We've got a couple of people we're talking to in the new year. I'm probably maybe going to Japan in March at some point to do a little bit of a stage, but maybe more research mm-hmm. and development, quote unquote. You know, we're really going to try to just sort of expand, our own education within Oka mm-hmm. to make sure that everyone has the same set of understandings about sake and shochu mm-hmm. and so that there's not one person relied upon there. And I think in that, you're going to find a more pleasurable experience because that's really what we want to do is just impart, you know, what we love and what we're doing to the guest, just to make sure that they're comfortable with it and they understand why and what and wherefore. But at the end of the day, let's just hope it's really delicious and they enjoy it and come back at least 3 to 4 times a week.
At least. Well, John, that sounds like a great, delicious, and educational mission.
Please accept it.
Thank you, John. That just about wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for
coming
on the show.
Thank you for being. Thank you for having me.
So for our listeners, what's the best way to stay up to date on news from you, from Oka?
The Instagram is Oka, O-K-A, underscore NYC. We also have a Facebook page. I believe it's Oka Restaurant. And we're at 439 3rd Avenue. It's between 30th and 31st Streets on 3rd Avenue. Stay tuned. There'll be a lot of good things coming.
Awesome. Oh, yeah, I forgot to ask. What does Oka mean?
Hill. Yeah, my friend Chris Johnson is responsible for that. It just happened to be to my partner, Simon Shi. It happens to be his wife's family kanji name as well. So,
also Murray Hill.
Murray Hill. That's the whole reason for it. So
there you go.
There were so many intersecting stars and whatnot. It had to be the name.
Love it. Thanks again. And fellow listeners, please head on over to feastmeetswest.com or at feastmeetswesteats on Instagram, or you can search feastmeetswest on Facebook to keep in touch with your FMW news and updates, including episode summaries, interview profiles, and much more. We'll be back next week with another awesome conversation from the world of Asian food.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.